Good morning, Colorado. Here we go. Y'all ready for this? The Bell and Pollock Legal Show, the only show of its kind. You can call us and ask us a question on any legal subject. We're here for you. In our day lives, we're injury attorneys, but right here on this radio, we're here for you. Telephone number 303-713-8255, 713-8255. And in the mountains, you can call us at 970-457-1009. We're glad to answer your questions, and we're glad to do it. Today at 10 o'clock in the morning, we're going to have our one-hour injury show that we do every Saturday on KOA, 850 AM. And we're going to be talking about bad faith insurance practices. Bad faith insurance practices. So what is that animal? What does it look like? What does it mean? Who cares? Well, when you deal with your own insurance company on any matter, it can be in the car accident context, it can be damage to your house, damage to your roof. You are dealing with your own insurance company, and they owe you certain duties and obligations. And the Colorado Supreme Court has classified it as a quasi-fiduciary relationship. What does that mean? You can listen today at 10 o'clock. So if you're in an accident and you're trying to collect your medical bills paid under MedPay on your own car insurance company, that law kicks in, the common law of bad faith and the statutory law of bad faith. If you're trying to collect your UIM and UM, uninsured motorist condition coverage, that law kicks in. If you're trying to cover hail damage and have your roof replaced, that law applies. So you're going to want to listen to that at 10 o'clock this morning. Joining us live right now is Robert. Good morning, Robert. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
Good. What is happening?
Boy, this drives me crazy. It doesn't have to be Boulder, but just in general, these cities and the city councils and the county commissioners seem to pass these small laws that prevent certain things, like we don't like a certain kind of fence because it disturbs the feng shui of the land. So they have a little city council meeting, get 100 people to comment on the subject, and still pass it the way they want to, just to show that they're being effective in office. And it drives me crazy. How can they do these, make these stupid laws that become laws that really affect a number of people, but only a small segment are interested in passing such a law?
Right. Well, they have their own autonomy, and we have the home rule, city rule, and we have the other rules in Colorado. But as long as it has a legitimate, and that might be arguable, a legitimate governmental interest, that might be arguable, then they have the power to do it. But remember what we've talked about in the shows over the years, that, you know, you can have an ordinance passed by a small town in Oregon. You can have it passed in Boulder. You can have it passed by a medium-sized town in Virginia.
Why don't they make it a ballot issue?
Yeah, well, they still have the power. They don't make it a ballot issue because they have the power to pass the ordinance. But remember, even an ordinance, a small ordinance, is subject to the United States Constitution and the Colorado Constitution. And that's where most of the challenges come from. But, yeah, I mean, they pass laws and ordinances that you don't like. Yeah, right.
Go ahead.
It's been that way forever, and it's very frustrating at times because the only real recourse you have is to vote out your city councilman. You know, we go back to our basic civics classes, Robert, where we have...
Any more civics classes.
Right, you got a good point. Whether they're even teaching people about what goes on. But
people are reluctant to do anything because they don't know how to do it, or they can't seem to find their self-reason to do it.
And, you know, I think Gary hit it right on the head when he told you exactly how it works. You know, you've got home rule cities, you've got cities that are on home rule, so the home rule cities have a little bit more power. But what you're dealing with is a situation where it's a legitimate governmental interest in governing the city, as long as it's not violative of our constitutional rights that are given to us by the federal government and the state government, they can go ahead and manage the city the way they see necessary. And it's a management technique that they're allowed to do.
You know, a really good example is some, let's say a city, any city, passes an ordinance that discriminates against a class of people based on race, color, creed, religion, belief, etc. So they want to do it, and they do it, and that's the ordinance. But then, and that's an easier one to argue because then it does violate the United States Constitution. It's struck down, but then that's a long process to go through to get that done. That's an easier one. It's a harder one, as you just said, when they pass an ordinance, depending on the aesthetic quality of fences. It's a harder one.
Well, and I don't know. I saw it last night in passing on the news. I didn't see a lot of it, but we're going to see that put to a test, I think, in a Boulder that recently outlawed the guns.
Rifles, these are simple rifles. I mean, then they start to characterize types of rifles. It's not what the rifle can possibly do. It has to look a certain way. It has to be a certain color. Well, if it's pink, that's okay, because it's pleasing to the women. But anything that's dark brown or black, well, we're going to outlaw those. So you start painting your rifles pink.
Yeah. And of course, that's already being put to a constitutional test. I understand there are already there's already plans to contest that, saying that the city in essence is violating the constitutional rights of persons to bear arms, and they're going to attack it.
Well, is that like the first step for everyone as a mirror idea for everyone to possibly see how it's going to go throughout other cities and other counties?
Well, I mean, they can do that, but that issue raises a fascinating legal, fascinating legal questions, because everybody in this country is so polarized on the Second Amendment, et cetera, and guns. But look at it legally. So everybody says the Second Amendment, so the Second Amendment talks about the right to bear arms. Okay, but legally, no, I don't care about your political position on anything.
No,
but legally, what does the right to bear arms mean? And then there's a whole set of laws and judicial officers that interpret just the plain meaning of the words, right to bear arms, nothing further. And then there's a whole set of judicial officers that give it an interpretation. What does the right to bear arms mean? Interpret. And so there, on the legal aspect, and then you're talking about this ordinance, does that infringe upon the Second Amendment? And if it does, why? And if it doesn't, why not?
Well, what if they decide to outlaw electric cars in Boulder just because someone's afraid of electricity? And they get a whole bunch of people that are afraid of electricity, and there are a lot of people that don't know what electricity is. So they outlaw electric cars in Boulder.
You got to go back to the root. The root challenge is the United States Constitution, the Colorado Constitution. And you say, well, that's a bunch of legal mumbo-jumbo. Well, yeah, but that's what it is. That's exactly the way it is. You can't and I gave you the simple example. You can't pass an ordinance that discriminates based on race, color, creed, religion, etc. Well, what about electric cars?
What about common sense?
Well, yeah, you got to have that. But that goes into the part of the law of the judicial officers that say, well, you got to apply common sense to the statute or the Constitution. Well, it's not written in there. And then the strict constructionists say it's not written in there. It has to be written in there.
Well, Robert, I don't know a lot about the reorganized church of the Latter-day Saints or the Mormons, but it's my understanding it's my understanding that they have colonies of actually cities, that they have certain rules that have to be followed. And they say, if you don't like the rules of our city, that their colony, their group, our city, don't live here. And they say those rules don't violate constitutional rights.
Yeah, how can they become sovereign? That's an interesting question. I mean, why can't someone wall off an area of Boulder and call it their own city and just...
Well, another. Who can form a city? Look at the city of Centennial, Colorado. Who can form that? Who did that? How'd that work?
I think some of them can, Robert. And I think sometimes, hey, if you don't like our city laws, move. But as we can enforce these city laws, as long as they don't violate the constitutional rights of citizens.
Well, the city of Centennial was a fascinating lawsuit over whether they could form it, and it was made by a judge's decision, ultimately, that the city could be formed under the statute. Hey, Robert, thanks for the call, man.
Thank you.
It's a good call, buddy.
All right, thanks. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show. We're rolling, 303-713-8255. You know the drill. We're here for you. Our website, championsofthepeople.com. We'll be right back.
Up and down this road.
Hey, 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 mama. Look at that sip out in the backyard. Take a look at this. Hey, 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 hey.
All right, here we go. Come on. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show, the only show of its kind. Remember, today at 10 o'clock, we've got our hour-long injury show. That's every Saturday on KOA, 8:50 a.m. Today, we're talking about bad faith insurance practices. When you deal with your own insurance company, what are the rules? What are the principles? What can they do? What can you do? And you want to listen to that show today at 10 o'clock in the morning. Joining us live for Law Talk is Sherry. Good morning, Sherry.
Hi. Thanks for your show. I'm I'm assuming that you've heard that stuff about Porter's Hospital on the TV.
Yes, we have.
I am one of the people who had a spinal surgery during that time, and I called them immediately, and they told me I would get a letter, and I got the letter, and it has where I can go to LabCorp and get tested. But when we have a car wreck, there's certain things we're to do and not to do to protect ourselves, and I just want to know, in this case, Porter's is going to pay for everything. What happens if you end up finding out you're infected? And do you folks have any advice for people in this position?
I think Porter's is looking at, first of all, let's talk about it. I don't have a lot of information, and I don't think anybody does, about what really went wrong here. It sounded like it was some kind of pre-sterilization that was supposed to occur to the instruments.
Right. They said it was during the pre-sterilization, and they're only going to test for three things. Are those the only three things you can catch?
Well,
did they have somebody who was infected doing that pre-sterilization? And that's why they're testing for those things.
And that's exactly an interesting part about this is they're talking about the pre-sterilization cleaning of these of these items. And we're, you know, my funny thing, my wife and I were just talking last night when we heard it on the news. We said, okay, what do you mean? What happened in the pre-sterilization? Why wasn't it caught in the sterilization? Where was the breakdown in procedures, or was there a breakdown in procedures? And if there was a breakdown in procedures, yes, there's going to be liability. And that's exactly it. They're having it being tested for the three things. And I think it was AIDS, hepatitis, and I forget the other one.
It's hepatitis B and hepatitis C and HIV.
And HIV. And so
three things.
Right. And is that everything that can be caught? And because they haven't explained what happened in the pre-sterilization process and how it occurred, the bottom line about this is that, yeah, I think this is going to lead to litigation. And I think there's going to be some litigation about what happened. It could very easily be consolidated litigation or class action. They've already they've dated it back to, I think, April of 2016 now.
Yes. And they're doing five tests. I got the letter. It says testing codes. There's five testing codes. So doesn't that mean they're testing for five different things?
Well, or are they doing five? Are there five different tests that will tell you whether or not those conditions are there?
But the bottom line is the legal answer is yes, they have a duty and obligation. Yes, they have duties and obligations to not let this happen. If it happened the way it was described, that can be classified as a breach of the duties and obligations. And then they all have insurance companies, and they have very good lawyers that defend these cases. So let's take it one step further, Sherry. So if somebody's tested and they're negative, and so you think, wow, everything's fine, and then you're tested and it's positive, what's going to happen? Well, what they normally do in these situations, and I don't know how this is going to develop, but legally speaking, what they normally do is try to offer you some kind of recompense that does not match what you could otherwise recover in law. And I want everybody to understand, we preach how insurance companies do these cases. Eventually, when you make the claim, and you have to make a legal claim, so eventually what happens is they say, well, we're not responsible.
You can hang up. Let me go.
Okay. All right, we'll continue.
Bye.
Thanks, Sherry. Appreciate your call. Okay, so the bottom line is then they defend these cases. They vigorously defend these cases by saying, well, yet you contracted HIV, but you can't really prove it happened in our hospital in 2016. You contracted Hep C, and you can't prove it. And so if anybody thinks that this is just a lay down situation and it's going to just be easy, that's wrong.
Well, what she was asking is exactly right. The first thing is there's been no real disclosure that I've seen as far as what the pre-sterilization process breakdown was and what caused these instruments to have problems or what they missed. There's been no explanation as to how it was missed or why it was missed. And it wasn't negligence in procedures or in carrying out the procedures or an oversight of the procedures or in the supervising the procedures. And then really, are these the only three potential hazards that can occur? But there's a lot of people involved. And the fact that they've shut down all their surgeries, They're not doing any more surgeries right there right now out there. So it tells me they are not even certain they have it resolved right now.
Exactly. So legally speaking, you got on one theory of law, negligence, you have to have a duty or duties, They have to breach those duties to you. And most importantly, where they usually attack these cases is then they say, well, okay, we might not have done it right. We might have a duty and obligation, but you can't prove that we caused, huge word, caused, underscore that word, caused your particular malady. But you can, but it's hard. And you've got to have attorneys that know what you're doing. Because I understand the attack before the attack comes. It's just go back to my military days. Right now we're going to talk to Ron. Good morning, Ron from Golden. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good. What can we do for you?
I have a question about workers' compensation.
All right.
My son was injured and missed work, and as a result of that, the workers' compensation program was activated in his case. And this is a situation. An insurance company apparently issued him a check, and he didn't think he received it. And more than 60 days passed. He contacted the insurance company to say he hadn't received his check, and they said that because 60 days had passed, they weren't under any obligation to issue a new check to him.
Okay, a couple of questions, and we'll be glad to answer your question.
Sure.
So he was injured on the job. It looks like they didn't fight the fact that he was injured on the job, because sometimes they can do that. That's called a contestability situation. But so he's getting a check. Was he not working or working part-time or able to go back to his job?
He did go back to his job eventually, but he was not able to work in that period of time.
Okay, so he was off work during that period of time, and they were paying him. You get 2/3 of your average weekly wage when you can't work, and it's tax free.
Right.
I don't know of any such excuse. You just knocked me off my chair, Ron.
Yeah.
60 days.
Right. They said it was in the Colorado law statutes that. So they issued him a check. I think it was in the neighborhood of $700.
Right.
And this check sat in an envelope in his apartment, and he didn't think he had received it. And finally, eventually, he found the envelope, opened it, and called the insurance company. I think he'd already talked to the insurance company, but they said because they wouldn't issue him a check because the check expired after 60 days, and that they. According to Colorado law, they weren't obligated to reissue a new check.
So they're saying they don't have to, they don't have to issue a new check for a lost or stale dated check.
Yes,
that's what they're saying.
Yes.
Did they identify the law on that?
Yeah,
I don't think so.
Well, I got one bit of advice for you right here, and we'll be glad to help you and your son. No problem. But as we always say, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And we've dealt with it like when homeowners associations say you can't do XYZ, when insurance companies say we're not going to pay for your roof,
mm-hmm.
Or car companies, we're not going to repair your car, or you're excluded from hail damage. Now here, we can't pay you because the statute says we can't pay you for a stale check. So in all those situations, you always ask the question in writing. Then you furnish to me the provision of the statute that you're talking about in writing, and you furnish me a copy of it.
Okay.
And that's the starting point.
Okay.
Because many times, not all times, many times they can't do it. And when they say you're excluded under this insurance policy because of XYZ, well, show me, what are you relying on to say that? And that would apply right here.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not making any sense that they're saying that it's money that was owed, and it's money that's owed under the workers' comp.
Mm-hmm.
Process, and unless they're saying for some reason that money is no longer owed, they owe the money. The money's owed, and you're entitled to get your money.
Right.
And if he had a legitimate claim that was processed and he's entitled to collect, then he should have been able to collect it.
Okay.
Let's get your name and number off the air. We'll have a we've got a couple lawyers who deal a lot in workers' comp in our office.
Okay.
And we'll have them. Is this Pinnacle Insurance Company, or do you know who the insurance company is?
You know, he told me at some point, but I can't remember the name.
Okay, I'd like to find out and what they're trying to rely on to say that, you know, we go back to the question, do they have to reissue a stale dated check? Well, do they owe the money? And if the money is owing and they're supposed to pay it, then the question is what makes them think they don't have to pay?
Well, the other thing that missed me, Ron, but this issue is he was off work, and usually you're off work where you get more than one check. In other words, when you that you know that's called TTD under the Workers' Comp Act, temporary total disability, and you get more than you get more than one check. You get a check every other week, and that's mandatory. So do you know if it's just one check issue or more than one check?
That was my understanding, but you know I should probably talk to him again and get more detail.
Okay, tell you what, you give Kevin your information.
Okay.
We're going to have you guys called. We'll give you some help and get down to the bottom of it. And even if we have to call the work comp division, because sometimes, many times in our office, the workers come in and they say, well, they haven't even paid me. They won't pay me my TTD, which is, and it's automatic. It's mandatory. There's no discretion. You have to do it. So we'll give you some help. So I'll give Kevin the information, okay?
Super. Thank
you. Hey, Ron, thanks
we'll
for the call, man.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, the Bell & Pollock Legal Show. Gary Bell, Brad Pollock. Our law firm is Bell & Pollock. We do cases all over the state of Colorado. For over 30 years, we've helped people put their lives back together again, injured victims. We're glad to help you. We have an office in Greenwood Village, Denver, and Steamboat Springs. Our website, championsofthepeople.com. We'll be right back. Fasten your seatbelt. Here we go. The Bell & Pollock Legal Show, the only show of its kind. Our 10 o'clock show this morning on KOA is on bad faith insurance practices. You know, we had a workers' compensation question right before the break, and we're going to get back to that in a minute. But in the next few weeks, we're going to have a complete workers' compensation show on our KOA show at 10 o'clock on Saturday mornings. That's coming up. So if you want to listen to that, I can't tell you the exact day, but maybe by next week I'll be able to. So right now, joining us live is Eric from Caitlin's. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Good. What's cooking?
Good. We got some specials going on. We got some new specials. We'll start with that breakfast special. We're doing breakfast tacos. Now we're taking seasoned ground beef, scrambled eggs, shredded cheese, lettuce, tomato, loading that up in a flour tortilla with a side of hash browns. You can also get our scratch-made red or green chili sauce on that. And we're also offering a tomatilla salsa on the side with that special. That's really good. So that's going to be the breakfast special all week. And then our lunch special is going to be a Bradley salad. We're going to take a bed of greens. We're going to load that up with shredded cheese, diced bacon, smoked turkey, tomatoes, cucumbers, sunflower seeds, croutons, the whole mix on there, dressings of your choice. That's going to be the salad special and the lunch special all week. And guys, don't forget, on Mondays and Fridays from 11 to 2, we do the all-you-can-eat taco burrito buffet. It's every Monday. It's every Friday. We run it from 11 to 2, all-you-can-eat. It actually includes a non-alcoholic beverage and the price of that buffet. So come on down every Monday and Friday and check that out. We've got crafts and mimosas going. The deck looks a little chilly, but the flat screens are on, baseball's on, sports are going on, all kinds of things happen at Caitlin's. So tons of other items on the menu to check out as well, all scratch made. Come on down and check us out.
The deck looks a little chilly is an understatement.
But the green chili is nice and warm.
Yeah, there
come
you
on
go.
Down and try that, and that'll cure what ails you, I guarantee it.
I was going to ask you if that green chili will keep me warm on the deck.
It will keep you warm on the deck, and it'll knock anything you got going on in you right out. So.
Where are you located?
All right, guys, we are 4379 East Mississippi Avenue. Now, it is one block east of Colorado Boulevard, and there's the Glendale Shopping Center. Come and check us out, guys.
All right, there's no food delivered to the studio. I'm counting the days. I got a calendar right here.
I'll get you. All right, I'll get you down right now.
All right, Eric, thanks.
Thanks, guys.
All right, the Bell & Pollock Legal Show. You know, right before the break, we were talking to Ron about this workers' comp matter. So, Ron, if you're still listening, during the break, one of our work comp attorneys in our law firm texted us and called us and said what the insurance company had told you and was doing to you was a bunch of, and I can't, this is a non-legal word, so I can't say it on the air, but, Ron, that's not correct. They have to pay you. They have to pay the money to your son, so we're going to get you some help, and maybe we can force them to do what their statutory duties say they should do. We're going to talk to Dean right now from Aurora. Good morning, Dean.
Good morning.
How are we doing on our situation?
Okay, you were talking. I missed the first 5 minutes of your show, but I think you were talking about some ordinances, and I think you were talking about the city ordinance in Aurora.
No, we were talking about the city ordinance in Boulder, but it could apply because some gentleman called in and said that he doesn't like the city ordinance, et cetera.
Well, you were talking about bad faith insurance practices.
Correct.
I think this is bad faith government practices here. Aurora, you didn't. I don't know if you watched the city council meeting. Maybe you don't. I don't know where you guys live, but they voted this, the first run, they voted this a moratorium in that's going to tie up trailer parks for 10 months before they can apply for a rezone.
Right.
That's what this the moratorium is about. And the fellow that wants to rezone has told everybody, you got to go, 2 years ago. And now everybody that lived there went to the city and said, we don't have any place to go. There's no more trailer parks. We can't move. And so I think that the city is punishing this guy, taking and holding up his land, because the city's got a big problem because there's 100 trailers there that they're going to have to deal with because it's going to get rezoned. And part of this, the city, I think the city's in violation of their own ordinance that they put in place in 2009 called the Comprehensive Plan. And that place has got, it's already got imprints of hotels and this and that and other thing of future planning. But up jumps this problem of everybody being displaced. And so the city goes crazy. And now they come up with this lane brain idea of this moratorium, I think just as a holding pattern for these people because they don't know what to do.
Okay, Dean, this is a legal show. So I understand your position and you've been following this pretty closely. But, you know, so the legal question is they passed the moratorium. Can they pass the moratorium? Do they have the power to do it? And if not, how do you fight it? That's how cities do get sued. That's how cities get sued for injunctions. And so, I mean, yeah, there's a group of people that like it. There's a group of people that don't like it. And the city is going to do their own thing. But the bottom line originating question, the genesis question is, do they have the legal authority? Is it a legitimate state government interest to do this? And if so, then why? And I understand you may not like it. And I know you follow it very closely, but that's the bottom line. The bottom line question. And by the way, at the top of the show, we were talking about whether or not it violates the United States Constitution, the Colorado Constitution, whether or not the city has the authority under their charter, and if they're a home rule city, whether they have the authority to issue such a moratorium. What's the legitimate government interest to issue this moratorium? There's one of the main questions.
Dina, I remember years and years ago, I ran into a little bit of this when I was trying to represent somebody who wanted to put up a condo unit and actually a multi-condo unit up in Breckenridge, and he wanted to include a restaurant and a workout facility. And of course, putting up condominiums in Breckenridge and being able to sell those was very, very lucrative for land builders back then. And we talked about the city plan and what the city plan provided for. And, I haven't kept up with it since then, but I remember, you are right. The cities normally will put together a land use ordinance or land use plan to see how everything fits within the plan. And, then once they pass the plan for the ordinance and their zoning restrictions of where you can have multi-use and where you can have other types of zoning, where you can have commercial, where you can have mobile family homes or multifamily homes and single family homes. And once that plan's in place, then to change it, especially if the use is already in effect in that area. So if you've got a multifamily unit sitting in a multifamily zoning district that was approved by the city and is part of their plan, and then all of a sudden they say, now we're going to change to single family, you can be talking about an unlawful taking that, once again, legally then starts saying when a city wants to do an unlawful taking or wants to do a taking of somebody's property, they have to do it in an appropriate way, and they have to pay them for what they're taking. The question on this mobile home, this guy's got to have lawyers that are beating down on this, doesn't he?
Well, the other thing on my take on this situation is, in my view, and we're talking legal, this is a law show, there's no question that the city of Aurora and the way they're handling this has affected this gentleman's property rights. No question in my mind.
The city attorney would disagree with you.
Yeah, I know. Sure. I know he would. He said there was.
They always do.
there was no taking of the property, and it's a legitimate government interest,
right,
and that sort of thing. Yeah, he would disagree. But the bottom line is there is a taking. There is an affecting of the property rights. So you got to morph to the next question. And I'm sure somebody's going to brief this, but the morph to the next question is what is the legal authority to do this? Does it violate the United States Constitution? It is an improper taking. And then you go back, Brad was just talking about the law of condemnation. They have the right to condemn, but it doesn't look like they're condemning it. They're just holding it up. They're impeding it. And so they're going to say the legitimate state interest and governmental interest is the fact that they don't want people displaced from the homes. And the city attorney said, well, it doesn't just apply to the Meadows. It applies across the board to everybody. But the point is they issued a moratorium on the rezoning, and they have to get into the Constitution. But all this is nice legal talk. Somebody has to file a lawsuit. It's very expensive to do so. Somebody has to file the lawsuit and make them stop it if they think they can do it. And that's how these things get into court. I think, yeah, you're right. The city attorney would not agree.
Yeah. Does Meadows Property have an attorney that's going after this? Or
The city attorney, the guy that owns the Meadows, nobody that owns these trailer parks knew about this moratorium. I follow politics, the city politics, a little bit more now than I used to, but they don't have to. And so, and I approached the guy owns the Meadows down there, and I talked to him, and he didn't know anything about it. Well, he called his lawyer, and his lawyer spoke at the city council meeting, and I did, and so did the guy that owns the property. And then everybody that lives there, they spoke, and they were overwhelming. There was 50 or 60 of them, and there was three of us.
Yeah.
And I see the people that live there. It is a problem for them because they don't have a place to go. But the city's own plan is to they're in conflict with their own plan, doing what they're doing.
Well, and that's exactly it. There are some property interests which can attach. And that's why I was wondering, Meadows Mobile Home, do they have somebody that they've got to have a lawyer that's well versed in this? And it's like, well, I said, years ago, I used to do some of this up in Breckenridge, and I know that, you know, this is a very sophisticated, very narrow point of law where you need people who are well versed in this. And I mean, this guy that owns the Meadows Mobile Home Park, he's talking to tens of millions probably worth of value here.
Property as a trailer park is the value they're talking on, that's $22 million as a trailer park.
Yeah,
he wanted to rezone it to fit in with Fitzsimmons. That's got to be as hot a property as any property in Denver.
It boils exactly down right to the restrictions and restraint on the free alienation of property. Hey, Dane, thanks for the call.
Hey, thanks.
All right, the Bell and Pollock Legal Show. We're here for you. Don't forget about the show that follows our show, the Consumer Real Estate Show. You know, today they're going to be talking about learning the process. What's the process of selling and buying real estate? And they also got one of their great seminars coming up a week from today, April 14th. It's for 3 hours in the Denver Tech Center. The Consumer Real Estate Show, Barry and Larry, very knowledgeable. The process, they're educational. They will teach you. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Bell and Pollock Show. In our day lives, we're injury attorneys, and we bring the show to you for your service, and we're glad to do it. Today at 10 o'clock, we're talking about bad faith insurance practices with your own insurance company when you're dealing with your own insurance company, when you are. And tomorrow morning, we'll have our regular blog in the Denver Post. We're talking about teen drinking and driving in the summertime. There's some statistics in there that I think are going to knock you off your seat. I didn't really realize it myself until the research was done, but it was kind of amazing. So right now we're going to talk to Tom. Good morning, Tom. What can we do for you?
Hey, I was involved in an accident that I caused. It was a DUI.
Right.
About a year and a half ago. And I had my jaw broken. So I was taken to the hospital, and they repaired the jaw. And the doc said, we're going to keep it wired for a couple months, and then we're going to see how it looks. Well, 2 months went by. He took the wires out. My jaw was really badly crooked and poorly aligned. And he said, well, it'll get better. You know, your muscles will retrain themselves, etc. Well, it didn't happen. What started happening is my crown started breaking, and my front tooth started chipping. And I went back to him and I said, "Is there anything you can take care of? I mean, this, you know, I've got pain along the jawbone, and it's constant." And he said, "No, I'm not really a jaw guy."
Not a jaw guy.
Yeah, that's what he said. I'm not a jaw guy.
All right, go ahead. And
so he couldn't help me. He said, "You're going to have to go find somebody that can help you." And so I spent like 3 months rehabbing the knee, and then I went looking for a doctor. Finally, I found a doctor that was, they were out of network, but I found a doctor that said, yeah, he could do whatever he needed to do to fix it. It was going to cost about $24,000. And I said, "Well, why couldn't this original doctor take care of it?" And he said, "Well, he basically messed it up. He didn't do a good job." And so I called a lawyer, and I said, "You know, I've got a lot of pain, and I had a problem for the past 6-8 months or whatever." And he said, "Well, unless it's catastrophic and permanent, we don't even worry about stuff like that." So I kind of figured I was out of luck. So the interesting thing is, 16 months later, I get a bill from this original doctor for like $5,000. And it's like, are you kidding me?
Right.
Are you kidding me? You got the audacity to send me a bill when you knew you messed up my jaw. And now I'm scheduled to get my jaw fixed here next month. So I know there's like a 12-month thing where once you realize you got an issue. Well, that happened. I realized I had a huge issue back in October this last year. But what is my recourse?
Tom, you're worrying me and you're worrying Brad. I can see it on his face, because the timing of this on the statute of limitations. So let's try to solve that problem first. So basically, the medical malpractice, any kind of hospital care, healthcare provider malpractice statute is 2 years. And it's called a discovery statute. What that means in Colorado is 2 years from the time that you discovered the incident and its cause, or the time that you should have discovered. So either discovered or should have discovered. And so it's 2 years. So when did this happen?
The jaw was wired up in July of 2016.
Okay. So in our law firm, we always take the worst date to us, even on a discovery statute. We don't rely on that. The worst date to you, it might not be the real date, but the worst date is the day of the event, okay? And you have two years. So you're coming up here in 2018, so you still got time, all right?
Right.
Okay, so that's that issue. The other issue is many, many malpractice attorneys say just what you just were told. If it's not catastrophic, you might have a case. I didn't hear those words, but if it's not catastrophic and permanent, we're not going to do it. And the reason is these insurance companies and their lawyers and these healthcare providers, especially hospitals, make these cases so expensive. There's your point right there. They make them so expensive. So what you described, I think Brad and I would agree, on its face, prima facie, would be malpractice.
Yeah.
Question is, how do you approach it? What do you do because of the expense, Tom?
Sure.
But I'd like to talk to you in our office off the air and have you come in and sit down and talk. We've got until July of 2018. And, you know, and for everybody listening out there, there is a statute of repose for when you find it. But in medical malpractice cases, normally you have at the very outset 3 years from when the event occurred. In most cases, it's 2 years. So everybody should be thinking 2 years from when they think medical malpractice occurred. But we need to get you in, sit down with you, talk to you about it. I don't know who you went to see, but we need to sit down and talk to you about it.
Well, it doesn't matter. There's things that you can do, Tom, and you need to have your eyes open and educated. We'll be glad to do it for free, obviously. But there's a game plan that you have,
especially when you've been sued for the or when he's now making demand for another $5,000
especially
on something he did wrong.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, that was it's just unbelievable, you know, and he was so coy about it. Well, I'm not a jaw guy, and I said, well, what do I do about this? My I can't chew, I can't talk properly, I can't whistle anymore.
And I'll guarantee you that the doctor that said he messed it up, I guarantee it, but I'll almost guarantee it, because I've seen this time after time after time, people come in our office and say, this doctor did a procedure on me a year and a half ago. And then I went to a subsequent doctor, and the subsequent doctor said the first doctor didn't do it correctly. And we say, okay, we'll have the second doctor put that in writing, and is she willing to testify? Answer no. Answer no. Not going to do it. Tom, we got to get you in and talk to you, okay?
All right.
Well, I mean, and we'll be glad to talk to you on the phone as well, because you got to get your eyes open. You still have a couple of things you can do here.
All righty. Well, I'll give you guys a call. I'm off after Wednesday next week, so I'll
Well, you can give man. Kevin your information right now if you want to. No. If not, you can just give us a call. No problem. You want to get...
I just don't want to give it to the whole world. I'll give you
No. You're going to give it on the private. I'm going to put you on hold, okay?
All right.
We'll put you on hold. They'll get your number, and we'll call you this week.
Thanks for the call, Tom.
You bet. Thanks.
We appreciate it. We appreciate all of your calls. We're going to take your calls in the order in which they've come. We got a lot of calls this morning. We're going to talk to Tom. Good morning, Tom.
Oh, is this me?
That's you, Tom. We're ready to go.
Yes, I was involved in a vehicle accident. We didn't call the police to come and investigate it, but we exchanged information. I gave her my insurance information, my driver's license, and my ownership information on the vehicle. And I got her telephone number and I believe her driver's license, but I failed to get the name of her insurance company. And then I went down to the Lakewood Police Department and filed an accident report. They told me I needed more information. Well, I have tried to contact this individual because she left me her number. And I'm just unsuccessful in getting it.
Okay, we're up against the wall on time. We're going to put you on hold, Tom. Give Kevin your information, and we will call you, and we'll help you.
We'll take care of you. There's a way to help you. We'll do it for you.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the call. We appreciate all of your calls. We're sorry we didn't get to the other calls. Terry, we're sorry. Jane, we're sorry. But you can give us a call next week, or you can leave your number, and we'll be glad to solve your problem. Don't forget about our show today at 10 o'clock. It's a one-hour injury show on KOA, 8:50 a.m. Today we're talking about bad faith insurance practices. If you want any of our books, 6 books free, go to our website, championsofthepeople.com. You can download an e-copy because we are your champions of the people.